Bobcat Goldthwait is a longtime comedian, actor, and filmmaker who is honing that stand-up craft here in Austin this weekend at the Vulcan Gas Company. Shows Friday and Saturday night. You can go to VulcanATX.com to snag tickets. Bob, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
I'm okie doke.
So I am really excited to get to check out your stand-up live and in person for the very first time this weekend. I loved Soldier for Christ. I actually had a chance to check that out over the last couple of days, and you've put out so much great stand-up over time.
Your
prowess as an entertainer, people maybe underestimate just what you are as a stand-up, but that's really how you got your beginning. And
and I kind of always feel that, like, that's my job. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I really love making movies and stuff like that, but I feel like that's my job, you know? And hopefully on my obituary, that's the first thing that pops up. But I don't think a lot of folks even know. You know, I do gigs now and I'll show up and they're, you know, they're used to booking people who get famous from something else. And then they go, oh, you have an act.
Not just that, but you're an important part of that second wave of comedians that really caused the art form to blow up in the 1980s at the Comedy Store. You didn't grow up in LA necessarily, though. You grew up in Syracuse. You start doing stand-up in the Syracuse area, the greater Syracuse area, whatever that entails, at the age of 15. When did you actually move out to LA to start trying to hone that craft at the Comedy Store and other places?
Well, I got started doing comedy when I was in Syracuse with Tom Kenny and Barry Krim is the guy I did a doc on, Call Me Lucky. But Tommy and I started. Tom Kenny, for folks, is SpongeBob SquarePants. So Tom Kenny and I started as teenagers doing shows, and then I moved to Boston when I was 18, and then I got on Letterman when I was 20. And I lived briefly in San Francisco, and then I moved to LA, and then it's weird. I'm 61, so I've been, if you count like starting, like being on Letterman, so that's 41 years. I did that math. I'm pretty impressed with myself.
You got on Letterman back in 1983?
Yeah, I got on Letterman, and you know how I got on? I actually called them. I was in Boston, and I'd say, hi, I'm Bob Goldthwait, I'm a comedian. And I'd be like, how do I get on your show? I really did. I went to information and called NBC until they eventually gave me the Letterman show. And then they gave me a talent coordinator. And then they said, well, we have audition nights, you know, once a month at like Catch a Rising Star. I took a bus down and I kept auditioning and then I got on Letterman. Isn't that crazy? I don't know if you could do that now, if you could just cold call the talk show and say, hey, I'd like to come on.
That is wild. That's an atypical path, too, because especially when you're talking about The Tonight Show, you had to be recognized. You had to be found at one of the comedy clubs.
Yeah. And usually you had like management or people like that. But I think I was just too stupid. So, yeah, I started calling Letterman when I was 19. I don't know. I would like to try and experiment and see what would happen if you tried to call The Tonight Show now and said, hey, I'm a comedian. How do I get on your show?
Oh, you would get shut down immediately. There's no way that happens now. But what you might be able to do is, I don't know. I don't know what the best route forward is if you're that hungry. You just have to find open mics and grind and hopefully.
Yeah. I think, but you know, I still do the equivalent of open mics. Like I'm in LA, I'm going to go up on a friend's show tonight. I that's where I end up writing more material, not as much when I'm, you know, I have this working class ethos. So when people come to see me, I always feel like I got to do a show for the people. But you know, when I do an open mic, I feel a little less pressure and I goof around a lot more. And that's where the material comes from.
Yeah, there's an interesting balance to be struck there because you do want to give people a show. You don't want to do all new material, but at some point you do have to try that material out for a crowd that doesn't live where you live. So a place like Austin, which all of a sudden finds itself as a stand-up mecca with Vulcan, where you're going to be this weekend with the Comedy Mothership, with Rogan, obviously. Cap City Comedy Club has been around for years, and the Helium people did a great job of bringing that one back. And some other clubs like that, too. I think people are more accommodating to you testing it out, especially if you preface it. Say, hey, I'm going to try some new material out here. Yeah. I need honest feedback on this.
Well, you know, when I would see Carlin, there was always a chunk of his time during the set where he actually brought out notes every time I saw him live growing up. And he would say, this is, I'm going to see. And he would be he'd go, nope, that's not going to be in it. That's not in the act and stuff. But yeah, I mean, I didn't even really think about it until just now. Yeah, comedy in Austin is what it was like, probably like in the 80s. San Francisco was the place, you know, it had a million clubs. But now that's not the case at all. San Francisco's gone. You know, they get these comedy clubs that are booked by, you know, Live Nation, and then that's it. So it's no, anybody trying something, do anyone taking risks or whatever is not going to get booked into those venues. It's really strange, but yeah, I guess it looks like Austin took the mantle from everywhere.
Yeah. The interesting thing about Austin, I know Rogan has talked about it on his show, is that you don't have to worry about any of the other BS. You're not trying to land a TV deal. You're just trying to get stand up. And so it takes a certain amount of pressure off of that. Now there's more competition here than ever before, so you have to take that into account, and stage time is a premium, but you can't be afraid of competition if you're trying to get into a business like this.
Yeah, I think that's great. You know, the idea that you're really just trying to hopefully trying to perform for yourself, you know, hopefully you're like up there. You know, I guess it probably seems like you in Austin, you might be trying to make the people in the back of the room laugh too. But yeah, the idea that do you know who's here tonight? That doesn't exist. But, you know, again, I think I'm at the phase in my career is like if somebody said, do you know who's here tonight? It's like, I don't care, you know.
That's a good place to get to though, because you all those inhibitions are completely gone by then.
Yeah, and it used to be, you know, I used to act like I didn't care. It was just like, you know, F you, you know, but that's just someone who's in a ton of fear who clearly cares what people think. You know, I was thinking about like I toured with Nirvana a little bit, and I really do feel that like Kurt, who was a really sweet guy, I felt like he probably did care what people thought to the point where it painted him in a corner. You know, there's a quasi-famous story of him buying a Lexus and people giving him enough, you know, ribbing him enough that he returned it. Because, you know, and it's like, you know, if he wanted his ass to be comfortable in a Lexus, you know, I'm sure he didn't give it any thought. I don't think he was going for status. He probably went to a car lot and said, oh, this one feels good, you know, not realizing he was going to get ridiculed. So I think like I said, you know, it was a lot more self-destructive, but that's all fear, you know. And I think also my stand-up and my career, I was like, you know, I would be so critical of what everybody else was doing. And then in the meantime, I'm in police academy. And I don't know if that was a defense, or I don't know if I just tore down everything and then you end up in, who did I think I was?
So you took that character on stage prior to Police Academy, but I still remember, I'm 15 years younger than you. So Police Academy was right in my wheelhouse back in the 1980s. In retrospect, we don't always have the greatest perspective on things. And I know you've talked about that and you joked about that over time as well.
Well, it was wildly entertaining
in large part because of you. Did you feel yourself starting to become that character over time because that's what was expected of you?
No, I was never that guy where I felt to be on all the time. I've always been punch the clock funny, you know. I've never felt the need to be on. I've always found that type of personality. Some folks that are on all the time, actually, I do like, and they're fun to be around, but in general, that's kind of an annoying person. So if I was just screaming, doing the Grover voice all the time. I think I've always been pretty selfish, though. I've always felt like I was playing for an audience of one. Like I was trying to make myself be entertained and then make myself, but then you get, you know, then what happened was the character was popular. And then I did feel like this is what people are expecting of me. And I thought I didn't like stand up, but what I didn't like was I didn't like that persona. So I had a jettison it. And I remember the night I was in Nashville. And I thought, oh, I thought I didn't like traveling. I thought I didn't like hecklers or the club owners. And then I realized, oh, you hate this persona. So I made a decision to go out on stage at the Zanies in Nashville on like a Friday night and just be me, and or an exaggerated version of me. And then I remember, you know, people were mad. They were like, do the voice, you know. And it's funny, when I used to direct the Kimmel Show, like during any kind of time I had to talk to Jimmy over the speaker, I would, like during a commercial, I'd say, hey, Jim, we're doing the blah, blah, blah. And he would just go, do the voice, you know. He would always want me to do that voice while I was directing the show. That's the only job I had. I mean, I was a grocery bagger briefly, but Kimmel was, you know, that was 3 years of showing up in the same place and getting to know people. And it was, I enjoyed it, but eventually I realized that I was, it had become a job, and I wasn't doing anyone a service by phoning it in. So I left and started making my small movies.
Was it just too much of a structure? You just didn't like how you were having to answer to other people?
No, it wasn't that it was too much of a structure. I just, you know, I made a small movie called Sleeping Dogs Lie. Oh, thanks, man. And I realized that was kind of where I was going. But I do know that at one point I got to the point during the music, directing the music, where I was just randomly calling out numbers for the cameras to move around. Like, I was like, oh, that's not fair to Jimmy or anybody else.
Yeah, I'm not going to have you retell the Nickelback story, but that is one of the funny bits on.
Oh, thanks.
Right.
You know,
people need
it
to.
It was, I would always wear a dumb hat to work at Kimmel. Like, I would, so like, it was to keep myself tethered, you know. Like, so if you're yelling at people and you're wearing a fez or a sombrero, you know, you're a douchebag. So I would always have a stupid hat on, and it would keep my ego, and it would keep my rage in check. And then one day I was mad about something, and I threw down my hat and I stormed out into the, and Cleto, the band leader, goes, oh, he doesn't have a hat, you know? So the hat was a code. Yeah. And I think by wearing dumb hats, it was, I kind of do this to the kind of a little bit, even now when I'm directing a movie or something, that I'll wear something stupid just to keep me to keep my brain in check. My daughter's a costume designer, and I was at Sundance for Call Me Lucky, and she found a Police Academy 2 wrap gift jacket, like a satin baseball jacket that said Police Academy 2 on it. And that's what I wore on the red carpet or whatever on Sundance. She goes, you better put this on. I go, good call.
I love how your daughter has definitely gained your sense of humor. I like to hear about y'all's back and forth with things. So that's
yeah, cool. Yeah. She's really funny, and she's super coming to her own. You know, she works all the time. She just, you know, she did like the Joe Parra show, costume design on that, and she's doing the new Bridget Everett show right now. So, yeah, she so it's funny. She is comedy adjacent all the time too. So that's, I just put that together. That's kind of funny that she works for comedians. I guess she speaks comedian.
Yeah. She speaks comedian. That's a good way to put it. So back in the early to mid 1980s, as you were really starting to make a name for yourself, you said that you cut your teeth in the San Francisco scene before moving to LA. Is that when you met guys like Robin Williams and Dana Gould?
Oh, no, I met both of them in Boston, actually. So I met Dana was insufferable when I met him. He was a few years younger than me, and I was pretty insufferable. So imagine that. Oh, he was brutal. And then, we have a tour doc called Joyride, and that's how it starts. He goes, "We didn't like each other when we met." And I was like, "No, that's not true. I hated you when we met." And Dana was like, "Yeah, and I hated me too. So we got along." But I met Robin in Boston. He was in town for something, and I was playing this comedy club. And this is back when I used to wear leisure suits, and I had all this runny eye makeup on. And the comedy club owner goes, "Get in the kitchen. I don't want Robin Williams to see you." And I was like, "Well, I don't know why." So now, then I'm hiding in the kitchen. I'm just sitting there, and he comes in, and he's like, What are you doing here?" And I was like, "Oh, they didn't want you to meet me." And he's like, "Oh, well, why not? Why? I don't know." And then that was how we became friends. And then when I moved to San Francisco, he'd come to my shows, and he never would speak to me. I would just hear this laugh in the back, you know, the famous, "I'm not going to do it," because that's how people do bad impressions of him. So I heard him laughing, and I was like, "Why doesn't this guy introduce himself?" It's like, but I think he really thought I was my persona or something, or just, I don't know why. He was kind of afraid of me in a weird way. So then I do remember the first time we actually hung out was we were watching the Motown special where Michael Jackson moonwalks in a dressing room, and we just hung out watching that.
What a random memory that is.
Yeah, but because at that point, I mean, I'd like to pretend that, you know, well, you know, we were just, but I remember sitting there going, "Oh my God, I'm watching Michael Jackson walk backwards with Robin Williams."
That's maybe, or hopefully it's a good memory number two with Robin Williams. Good memory number one being you guys making World's Greatest Dad together. That is, I'm not even overstating this, Bob. This is one of my all-time favorite movies. I remember watching it the very first time back in the early 2010s when it was out on demand or maybe one of the movie channels, and just being blown away. Amazing dark comedy, so well acted. It's poignant, just a wonderful exploration of somebody dealing with an unthinkable tragedy while also dealing with the fact that they're getting famous and maybe somewhat rich off of that at the same time. In terms of all the stuff that you've done in your life, where does making World's Greatest Dad rank in terms of the entertainment value for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's in regards to like work kind of things, you know, World's Greatest Dad is my favorite movie, and then Call Me Lucky, I guess, out of the ones that I made. Working on that was really, you know, we kind of spoke a shorthand because we were friends. So, you know, it was, I remember one day, I think it was the first day, I told him, because comics, you know, we're trying to get laughs, and we're trying to connect, and we're playing for the crew and the director, and, you know, we're usually big, you know, very broad, you know, I told him, I said, you know, the only person you have to worry about making laugh or connecting with is me. And I have headphones on. And I said, "See, let's just see how quiet you can be in this movie," you know? So that was something. And I remember him, you know, the first day I was like, "Well, I mean, I know we're friends and everything, but is he, you know, am I going to say, I think we should do it this way?" And he's like, "I have an Oscar and you were in Police Academy 2, 3, and 4. I don't really think we're going to do it that way." But it was the direct opposite. And one of the things I have learned, you know, I used to be afraid of especially people who were established, you know, telling them what to do. But most actors that are worth their salt do want, they wouldn't want input. They want to know you care. They want to know, you know, I haven't had anybody that said no to an idea, but I try to make an environment where people feel safe so they can pitch their own ideas and try their own things. And because at the end of the day, I have the say. I'm the one in the editing room, but I've never had an actor say, hey, you didn't use that take, because they don't remember. But what they do remember was that they got to be part of the process.
Am I remembering correctly that you attribute losing that inhibition about telling famous people what to do as a result of working on the Kimmel Show?
Yeah, 100%. You know, I just like, you know, when you're telling, it was weird. Like when you're telling musicians where to stand, you know, and I was like, you know, I'd be like, why am I can't, you know, when you, the first time I told Mike Tyson what to do was kind of pretty funny to me. And he kept calling me Bobcat Goldberg.
And, did you have to tell Mike Tyson, dude? I know you've told this story before, but this is incredible considering that it's Mike Tyson.
Oh, the when he fell? Yeah. Yeah, we were filming and he's on the back of a sled that's at a steep angle, and they're doing Winter Wonderland. Jimmy Kimmel's singing like, in the meadow we can build a snowman. And then Mike Tyson pops up behind him and goes, and we could pretend that he's Buster Brown or whatever. And so he goes to do it, and I think he was stoned. And he just fell off the back of the sled. Like, it was about 3 feet high, and there was like an explosion, like blam, really loud. And I go, I'd like to think I'm a better man than this, but I go, Mike, are you okay? Were we rolling? Like there was no pause. Like I knew Jimmy would want and hope that we had that on camera. Mike, are you okay? Did we get that? You know, there was no, were we filming? So yeah, yeah, you get that. That was a great place to learn a lot of things, like how to you know, and also for folks that, you know, for your big names or your medium sized names, you know, if I had it figured out where they're gonna stand and stuff, and you know when they were gonna cross or whatever, they appreciated that, because most of the time I didn't have any time at all for those sketches and stuff that you'd see on Kimmel. You know, we had to knock them out really fast, and I like that. It was comedy triage. You know, we have 2 hours to shoot this and film it and then get it in an editing bay and then go, you know, and then put it out. And sometimes when I'd be in the booth, the videos hadn't been uploaded into the profile of the computer. So I'd be sitting there during Jimmy's act one, and I go, do we have the bit? Do we have the Taco Bell bit? Is it in yet? And then he would come to it. And then, yeah, so that was exciting. I liked the broadcast news side of it when I was there. And then when it wasn't live anymore, it did kind of just start feeling like a job.
Did you ever get passed by Mitzi at the Comedy Store? Did your career take off before that ever?
Well, it kind of took off, but I had a manager at the time, so I was able to play all the rooms. And one of my first times at the Comedy Store, Whoopi Goldberg was doing this showcase for all these people, you know, and then she, at the end, she said, oh, I'd like to introduce you to my friend. And I went out and did a set. And when I remember going out on stage, and there was Richard Pryor right there, like, and then there was Sidney Pollack, and there was all these people, Mike Nichols, just all these people. And I did okay. And to this day, people go, oh, I saw you open for Whoopi Goldberg. And I'm like, Whoopi opened for me. All right. I went on at the end of the night. But yeah, so that actually was what, that's how I booked the Police Academy too. Paul Maslansky was there. And then I basically got the job from that showcase at the Comedy Store.
Bill Hicks is a beloved comedian in these parts. He got a start in Houston and then in Austin. Considering that you were in that LA scene when you were, did you ever have any interactions with Hicks?
Oh, yeah. There was a club called Igby's, and both he and I liked to go on, because they were the only showcase club where there was actually an end to the night. So it wasn't like, you know, I don't mean showcase. There was an actual show. There was an MC, a feature, and then a headline. And both he and I would come in after the headliner and do sets. So yeah, I got to know him there. I actually spoke with him pretty close to just before he passed away, because he was in Florida, and I didn't know he was ill, and he was in the room I was supposed to check in. And I was like, no, man, you don't have to move. And then I was in the hotel lobby, and I ended up talking to him about a half hour before he passed away.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I talked to him about a half an hour.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he passed away. I didn't talk to him, just because then I probably would have been calling for a hospice nurse or something.
911. Do you remember anything about that final conversation?
No, I remember it was very sweet. I remember it was very sweet. That's what I remember. It wasn't, we weren't talking crap about other comics. We weren't talking about politics. We were talking about just each other, and it was very sweet. That's all I remember.
All right, last two questions now. Bob, going to return to stand-up, or I guess stay on stand-up for this. You've directed a bunch of stand-up specials. What do you love about directing stand-up specials?
I really love doing it. I just did Kyle Kinane's new one called Dirt Nap. But I love it because I know what a comic, if I can make a comic feel that they don't have to worry about anything that day except doing their set, that makes me really happy. And some people want input structurally, with the material or tags even sometimes. And then other comics just want to know, what time do I get there? And I've worked, and some of them want to know all the, how it's going to look or have different ideas. And I like to facilitate them, but doing it for comedians, especially people like that I respect, like Patton or like Ron Funches, or, I've just, and Kinane is a monster, it is really, it is, I really love doing it. I was really happy that Kinane was the first one I had done since the strike, and it felt so good. It was really fun.
And final question now, what do you love about getting to do stand-up, considering that you want that listed first on your tombstone, hopefully 50 years
ago? It's the cliche. I like doing stand-up because you have an idea that day, or even up on stage, and you try it out and you get instant feedback. Whereas, I write and direct a movie, and from the idea to people actually seeing it is, best case, it's 2 years, or a year and a half. So I love the instantaneous kind of quality. And I have to say, when you actually have a genuinely an idea that you had not had before, and it lands, and it's not derivative, and it's an original thought, and it gets a laugh on stage, there's nothing like that, man. Yeah.
Very cool. I can't wait to check some of that out at Vulcan Gas Company. I'm going to be at the Friday show, but shows Friday and Saturday this weekend here in Austin. Go to VulcanATX.com to get tickets. Bob does a phenomenal job of weaving dark comedy with stories from his craziest Gumpian past. It is a hell of a good time. So,
well, thank you so much.
Check him out. Please do so. Bob, thank you so much for the time today, man. This is a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. And thanks for all the kind words, man. Thank you.
Thanks to Gentleman Jesus for the intro and outro music. Hear more of his work at gentlemanjesus.com. And thanks to you for hanging out. More of the show and to connect on social media, visit booksonpod.com. Talk to you next time, Books on Pod.